corner.
Okay.
I didn't actually.
It's Hans Hoppe.
No, you just said it.
And you really should look him up. I mean, every piece he does is, and half of them have been censored, and it's just amazing.
That's what I plan to do this weekend.
Right, so his name is Hans Hoppe. So I don't know if there's a student in here who's a contemporary student.
Are you watching the movie right now?
We're going to be finishing up the rest of the one that we started, but I don't know if she's going to do it at the end or at the beginning.
Those of you here are the A's and B's in the class, too. So it works out. No, he goes. So Edward, isn't that your name? JR is going to talk to you for a moment. I've given him a moment of my precious time.
Good afternoon, everybody. I know everybody's a little tired, but I'm here representing California Faculty Association. It's the main union here on campus. Represents a lot of the faculty here. As you guys know, tuition increases have skyrocketed 94% in just 5 years. They keep saying they're going to continue to raise tuition, as well as CEO executives, the board of trustees, campus presidents are making well over $400,000 a year on top of car and housing allowances. And in turn, we see a lot of cuts to classes. Right? We were fighting in order to get into this class. We see less and less people of color, low-income communities, being able to get into CSUs. And really, it is a waste of our tax money, and the tax money that a lot of our parents and ourselves work really hard, you know. A lot of us work 2, 3, 4 jobs in order to stay in school. So I just wanted to pass up some info. Front and back gives you a really great, just some great info about what's going on, because it pertains to all of us. If you're a student, you know, it affects you. We're having a meeting next Tuesday night. We're calling it a critical dialogue and a call to action to save public higher education. So if anybody's really interested in that, let me know. See me after class. But that's it. I'm just going to pass these out. Thank you, guys.
So why don't you explain to them why you're doing this, your internship?
I'm doing it mostly because, I do education, and, an easy way for education to be taken away, especially education that is a little more liberal, a little more political, is to just, take you out financially. And that's how, hundreds of thousands of years, that's how it's happened. So,
And aren't you doing an official internship?
Yeah, it is an official internship, but more than anything, if you guys have extra pictures, pass it back.
We're starting with the movie.
Look out for everybody's education, and everybody's trying to learn. Thank you guys.
Thank you. So even if you can't go to that meeting, I do think it's important. We all have different points of view. Yes?
I just have a quick question, the UC system just had to pay back like $40 million to 20,000 different students because they were like embezzling money within the UC system.
Yeah.
I didn't see that headline, but okay.
My experience with the CSU is that I wouldn't put it past them that they're doing the same exact thing, but nobody's leading the way. And so I heard about the Tuesday event.
Well, why don't you also tell the students what you do first Wednesday of every month?
I'm on the board of directors. I'm on Associated Students. And it's student government on campus. If you want to know what's happening with campus issues, that's talk to me during class or after.
No, after class. So we've got two good representatives from a student point of view in this class, which is I'm proud of that. So what we're going to do today, I don't think we're going to be here the whole period, but we're going to finish the Diego Rivera movie. So I stopped it right before Detroit. So it's a good resume of Detroit. Then it'll go to New York. And then I'll do my Frida Kahlo lecture, okay? Is everybody set? Now, don't fall asleep on me. If I have to stay awake, you guys can stay. And I have asked 4 times to have 1 light bulb change. What can I say?
They must be busy.
They must be busy. Right, because we don't even have heat these days. Where's the play? I'll find it in the play.
Ford Motor Company's immense industrial complex, the River Rouge. In Mexico, he had brought the experience of the campesino into his work. Now he would try to incorporate the experience of the American industrial worker. His frescoes from his earlier trip to the United States, the San Francisco Stock Exchange, and the California School of Fine Arts had been the beginning of his exploration of American industry and engineering.
That's at the Art Institute.
A year later in Detroit, the Ford photographer recorded Rivera at work. As Rivera had studied Detroit, so Detroit observed Rivera and the complex technique of fresco. To transfer Rivera's finished drawings to the walls, first an outline would be made with tracing paper. The outline would be perforated with a roulette wheel and put up on the wall in the proper position. Once in place, the tracing paper was daubed with powder to leave an outline of the original drawing. After the composition had been checked, it could be covered over with the final smooth coat of plaster. After retracing the outlines on the fresh plaster, Rivera would begin to paint. As he worked, Rivera had to keep in mind his overall composition, but he built his frescoes out of closely observed details. His sketches and his study photographs helped him design a work that would stand up before the exacting eyes of the Ford engineers and workers themselves. But he also saw something larger in the factories of Detroit, and he applied all of his skills as an artist. His Italian education is here in the use of perspective, and in the portraits of Edsel Ford and Art Institute director William Valentina, standing at the side of the fresco like Renaissance patrons. His experience with Cubism is here too, in his manipulation of space, in his emphasis on the geometry of the machine. Rivera saw a formal and a philosophical connection between these machines and Aztec ideas about universal order, and subtly changed the shape of this press, giving it some of the form of an Aztec sculpture. He wanted to paint, wrote his biographer Bertram Wolfe, the human spirit that is embodied in the machine and the hope that is in the machine. His goal was to convey the idea that technology is an expression of the fundamental unity of the world. Above the factory floor, allegorical figures of the four races of man and the fists of the miners who dig out coal and iron. The wave pattern found throughout nature is here in the underground geological strata, in the conveyor belt that Rivera made even more sinuous than in real life, and in the movement of the workers themselves. The end walls contain reminders that machines can be used for good or for war, that the engineer and the worker are joint masters of the industrial world. And as at Chipingo, an image of the interrelationship between man and nature. In late March 1933, having finished his Detroit frescoes, Rivera began a new project for Rockefeller Center in New York City. He intended to paint his vision of a new society based on science and technology. The work progressed quickly, with Rivera on the scaffold as always, a tourist attraction. Then on May 9th, with the mural still unfinished, security men appeared. Rivera and his assistants were paid and escorted out of the building. Days earlier, a face that had been unclear in the preliminary sketches took recognizable form. The Rockefellers objected, but Rivera refused to remove Lenin from the fresco. Rivera decided to use the remaining money from the Rockefeller Commission to paint 21 portable frescoes on his view of the revolutionary tradition in American history. Several of his assistants, including Lucien Bloch, Stephen Dimitrov, and Ben Shahn went on to become fresco painters themselves. After he returned to Mexico, Rivera learned that his Rockefeller Center fresco had been destroyed. Not to be silenced, he obtained a wall in the Palace of Fine Arts and painted this replica of the destroyed mural. Also in this period, still angry from his battle with the Rockefellers, Rivera returned to the unfinished wall of the National Palace, Mexico of the future. Fresh from his North American experience, Rivera painted a crowded, tumultuous scene full of battle. Marx, framed by a modern scientific sun, points toward the socialist future. The story of Diego Rivera's political life is a complex one. He was denounced by both left and right. He gave shelter to Trotsky when Stalin's assassins were on Trotsky's trail. He was in and out of the Communist Party of Mexico several times. All his life, Rivera saw the public role as an artist and sought to use his public status for political ends. He marched for political causes, but he also wrote, attended meetings, spoke out. He had his own vision of the revolution, ultimately too intuitive and heartfelt and mystical for politicians of any persuasion to be comfortable. In spite of the apparent contradictions in his political life, there was a profound unity to his artistic vision. If art has a social function like any other craft, if an artist is a visionary, creating for his time and place an all-encompassing unity of meaning, then art is by definition political. In one of his spicier moods, Rivera said, "If it isn't propaganda, it's not art." For the next 22 years, Diego Rivera would continue to paint. From his first murals at the National Preparatory School until his death in 1957, Rivera produced an immense body of work. In evaluating Rivera, it has been difficult for many critics to separate his art from their views of his politics. And in the past 40 years in the United States, realism and social content have fallen out of favor. What is Rivera's place in modern art? He worked within the great Renaissance tradition, but he was unique in his conception of a form of painting which merged the traditions of Western art, the anti-establishment avant-garde, and the ancient art forms of indigenous American cultures. In the span of one lifetime, he became the master of a school of art that was the Renaissance of a nation. In his last years, Rivera was world famous, lionized, photographed by everyone, and with everyone. He continued to be controversial, and he continues to paint. In the dream of a Sunday afternoon in the Alameda Park, Rivera portrayed himself as a curious child. He stands holding Death's hand in alliance with Posada, the master popular artist who saw through the sham and foibles of his time. In this fresco painted late in Rivera's life, there is no boundary between Mexico's story and his own. It is fashioned out of his own passionate version of Mexico's history, out of his self-confidence as an artist gifted with extraordinary powers of mind, memory, and imagination, and out of his deep tenderness for his nation and its people.
So somebody wanted to see the credits. Somebody asked me who narrated it. Oh, that person is not here.
Oh, well. So, here we are. Okay. Any questions about Rivera? So I have to go to number.
You should go hit ones.
No. Guys, kill me with this. So actually, this morning my pointer worked. Last night I lost the arrow. I was going crazy. I couldn't get this arrow to show up on my computer at all. So Frida Kahlo. So you saw bits and pieces of her in those murals. And sometimes they didn't even, what page is it?
17.
Thank you, 17. But some lecture first, okay? Frida Kahlo, when she was 18 years old, she was in a streetcar accident, which left her crippled, and she had a severe pelvis injury. And that kind of stayed with her and became a motif, in a sense, you know, aside from the brutal physicality of it, a motif of the rest of her life. And there have been many, many essays and books written about Kahlo from that particular psychological point of view, of her background and her physical injury and her sort of love relationship with Rivera and others. So you can look at her work psychologically, and I choose not to do that. So if you want to look at Frida Kahlo psychologically, go read another book. I look at her work politically, and that's what my lecture is about. She was consistently active in politics. And on July 14th, 1954, the day her body lay in state at the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico, her body was draped with a flag bearing the Soviet hammer and sickle on a star. So that was by, I'll have that slide coming up also, but that was her request, that was how she would be buried. And she was buried that way. She had first joined the Communist Party in the 1920s, and she believed in a particular kind of Mexican nationalism that sort of put her on the side of the left in Mexico. She was anti-Spanish, anti-imperialist, and pro-Indian. So that those factors together produced something in Mexico that I mentioned last time we met, indigenismo, or indigenicism. It doesn't sound right in English. What can I say, right? And some people call this, as an abbreviated word, mexicanidad, okay, which is sort of an easier way to say it, mexicanidad. So she, so this was how she looked at her politics and her country. I might mention that her parents were a mixed marriage, in the sense that her mother was more Hispanic Mexican and her father was more German Jewish Mexican. And this is also very interesting, and some of that is left out of some of the more sort of popular renditions of her story. So in a way, Kahlo's Mexicanidad was appropriately a romantic nationalism that fits in with the sort of romantic left-wing thinking of the 1930s. She romanticized and idealized the pre-Hispanic past, just like Diego Rivera did. She did it even more so than he did. And it is evident in the use of her symbols in her own art, and I'll point that up as we go along. Also, something else that Kahlo did that I've mentioned before, you know, it's sort of interesting to me in the film, they tell you that he looked at Aztec stuff, and they show you this fantastic machine, but why didn't they cut to a Coatlicue, right, like I did in lecture? And then I was talking to a student here I know is in the 204 class, and then there, I think he mentioned, what was he saying, a river or something? There was a band, this undulating band in the Diego Rivera mural, which is straight from an undulating serpent on the exterior of a temple at the pre-Hispanic site of Teotihuacan. So they, you know, one step further and they could have had a fuller movie, but, you know, they don't take that step. So anyway, but Kahlo and Rivera both studied the pre-Hispanic past, the indigenous past of Mexico, and used that in their art. So I want to begin, and I was talking to Ryan about this the other day. This is an ad that went up in many on billboards in the United States when a very huge, huge exhibition opened in New York City. It was, I think it was also in San Diego. It's called Mexico Splendors of 30 Centuries. And it was spring of 1991. And this is downtown San Antonio, Texas, along Interstate 35, right? But what's so interesting is here you have this major exhibit right in the beginning of the 1990s that uses, you know, Frida Kahlo, or a section of one of her paintings as the billboard. That is even more interesting. I lost it again. Oh, now I got it. Okay. So here, this is that same ad. So this is this campaign promoting this enormous exhibition. And the campaign completely always used that exoticized Frida Kahlo in its ad, in all of its ads. So this is Art in America, September 1991. And this is a version of that painting, Self-Portrait with Monkeys. And so just to show you where it all came from, this is one of her many, many, many self-portraits. And I want to back up for a moment. So in the beginning of her career, she became quite well known. At first, she was always referred to as Mrs. Rivera, especially in the United States. And then she built up her own career. And in 1938, she had an exhibit at the Julian Levy Gallery in New York City, where, quote unquote, the Pope of Surrealism, somebody I've talked about in this class, told you about, André Breton. And remember his role in Wilfredo Lam's career also? Okay? André Breton lauded her paintings, and by the 1940s, she was very well known in the early 1940s. In fact, she went to Paris because Breton called her a surrealist and gave her a one-person show in Paris. With the entry and the beginnings of World War II and the kind of Cold War propaganda that came out during and after World War II, Kahlo faded into the shadows. She was never mentioned in the press, and basically from the 1950s to the 1970s, nobody talked about Frida Kahlo. She was not well known. You wouldn't be carrying Frida Kahlo bags that you all carry and all the stuff you all do about her, right? She was completely off the radar screen until in the United States, in the early 1970s, the feminist art movement rediscovered her. So she was rediscovered in the United States by the feminist art movement, specifically by North American feminists, and they used her self-portrait as their tool in their campaign to reinstate her. So this is where her self-portrait comes to play a lot in sort of books and discourses about her. But she was always a rebel, and she always lived with this kind of rebellious attitude. She and Diego Rivera had constructed for them from 1932 to 1939 studios that were connected by this little bridge up at the top. This is full modernist style. I know I showed you the CERT building at the World's Fair, and I talked about international modernism, right, that style of architecture. So we're right in that. But being the rebels they were, Kahlo's studio was the blue building, and Diego Rivera's was the pink, just to show you, you know, that their rebellious nature kept going in their own lives. These buildings were restored in 1997, and I got this from a New York Times article, The Restoration in the Picture. So this is her studio, and this is his red studio, as they were restored in 1997. Here she is with the plaster cast that she had to wear at the end of her life. This is about 1950, and she painted it herself. She did it by having a mirror put up above her. So this is the hammer and sickle, the Soviet hammer and sickle. We're in 1950, McCarthyism, right? And this is how she painted herself. And here we have July 14th, 1954, her funeral, that funeral I mentioned before. And here is her casket, and you can see that draped on her casket. Boy, it showed up really well this morning, and now I'm back to almost nothing, right, is the hammer and sickle. So right up until her death, she was very firm about her beliefs. And here is that photograph you saw both in my lecture and in the film. This is the march in 1929, and there's Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo at the front line of the march with the Syndicate of Technical Workers, Painters, and Sculptors. And I've talked about that previously in this class. This is something else that the movie mentioned. This is another sort of little sort of fascinating footnote. The movie said that Diego Rivera gave Trotsky protection. Well, Frida Kahlo gave Trotsky protection and more than protection, okay? And so this was a cause célèbre in many, many ways. But here they are, really, this is when they disembarked, coming in from the freighter that carried Trotsky and his wife to Mexico in exile. And you can see Frida Kahlo is right there, you know, with them as they're disembarking. And here we have the first painting of Kahlo's that I'm going to talk about. So this is Kahlo painting in 1932. She's in Detroit. She went with Rivera to Detroit when he had the commission for the Ford Motor Company murals that you just saw. So she's in Detroit. He's working on those murals all the time, and she's at whatever home was. So it's 1932. And to understand the painting, you have to remember that they're in the United States when she painted this. And the painting I want to talk about is this one. It's called Self-Portrait on the Border Between Mexico and the United States. And it was done in 1932. So, first look up in the sky of the painting. I'm going to deconstruct it a little bit for you so you can see.